Toby, thank you so much for joining us today. You have an exceptionally interesting background. Obviously, we're going to go through this in a bit more detail, but an architect who's then started a tech company, who's then done a lot of different things in the built environment. So we're very interested to have you with us today to hear your story, but also to talk about where you see the challenges and the opportunities in the future as well, because you work with a lot of different business types as well in the entire built environment and property industry. So let's dive on in. So Toby, tell me a little bit about where your entire journey started.
Yeah, so I started as an architect early days, straight out of uni. I didn't want to do anything else out of school. I always wanted to be an architect. My dad was a builder, and so he was annoyed that he's like, oh, I deal with them all day. Now you're going to be one of them. Yeah, sorry. Always loved it, but knew I wanted to do my own thing, but I didn't really know how to do that. And I worked at a place for about 5 or 6 years that did only hospitality design. So I fell into it.
Yeah.
And then my future business partner, Will Leaf, came to me one day and said, I'm going to start, after he broke his neck, ironically. And he said, I've got to change something. Why don't we start something? And I said, okay. And I spoke to my partner, who's now my wife, and said, what's the worst that can happen? Like, why don't we give it a go? And so we had a go. We had an older business partner at the time who was only there for a few years because he had a golf course design business as well. But we just said, what's the worst? We have one job each. We had one house each, the reno. And we said, let's go. Let's try it. Didn't know what we were doing at all. We sat back to back in a cubicle, like sharing a keyboard type stuff. No money. Didn't pay ourselves for a while. But we knew that we liked doing it. We had the same goals. We were yin and yang. It was for different people, but in a good way. But we had the same networks of people that we knew, and we liked enjoying it while we did it.
Yeah.
And so
fundamental to it.
Yeah. And so that was the key thing we kept on going. We still like it. I mean, even if I said something and he said, oh, I think we should do it slightly different, it was always constructive. Then 14 years later, you know, we had 60 people. We had our own 4-story building, which had an office in, and stuff had gone right for us. We had multiple streams of income, did a lot of multi-res, still did a lot of hospitality. I still have to argue how to get them in because I didn't earn as much, but there's a whole thing of where balance of different jobs go.
Well, that's right. Different sectors with different cash flow points and all of those types of things,
And so it's but it meant that you had 60 people to listen to their problems every day. And so when you become more senior in a company, most of your time is looking after the people.
Yeah.
And so we went through COVID, which was obviously like everyone, and especially from being from Melbourne, it was 3 people in a 4-story building. It's all that was in there. So we were sitting around in like shorts and T-shirt and doing work, and because we were construction, but, you know.
I lived through Melbourne in COVID and managed 4 states at the same time. It's funny because I live in Queensland now and everybody's like, oh, COVID. I'm like, yeah, COVID in Queensland and COVID in Melbourne, two very, very different experiences.
Oh, it's really weird to explain to people. It feels like it was 20 years ago and it was only 4 years ago.
Yeah, I know. And you kind of go, well, my kids were born in COVID, so I've got this all constant reminder of how long ago it was, which it doesn't feel that long ago, but fundamentally it actually has changed. And we'll talk about this in the challenges and things ahead. Obviously, there's going to be – we're at a very interesting time with AI and obviously what's going on economically. But it made me think this morning because, you know, everybody's a bit, you know, bit worried about things at the moment, and we can have that chat about versus seeing it or seeing it as an opportunity. I thought, well, everybody panicked during COVID and it was the unknown. If the one thing we've taken from that is, and you've done this with different businesses, is that sometimes you just need to step into the uncomfortable and the unknown as well, and you will come through it. We don't know what it is. Humans don't like that. We like to know what's ahead, you know, all of those things, but we've been there, we've done it. And I think hopefully that's taught us a little bit. We're quite a privileged generation. We haven't really dealt with money except for COVID. We've had no major wars in our country or world wars have disseminated. So hopefully we can all sort of draw on some of the panic that we had then and apply that to future. Anyway, so back to where you were.
You're 100% right. That uncomfortable, everything changes the whole time. And I think people get set in what they're doing, and then when it changes, they go, well, I can't do it. They go, well, you have to. Otherwise, what are you going to do? Sit still. So we had, you know, you at Leaf got up to, you know, 14, 15 years old and still going, which is great. We also started a tech company called Land Checker in the background, which is a basically stemmed out of three of us coming up with an idea that we were sick of having five screens open to do our work and it should just all be on one.
Yeah.
So it's a spatial planning business that all developers, real estate agents, anyone in the property line are using. And it's still really strange that I go into the office occasionally, there's a full office, they've got 30 staff, and it's their career. It's really weird that just our idea became someone else's career. And we sold it and they got rid of the founders. But they said, you're in tech, but you guys aren't tech. You just came up with a good idea and you just followed it through and gave it a go. And so...
Well, and as you said before, you weren't necessarily, it was quite a process. You learned a lot about M&A as well. We'll talk about that. But in essence, because you weren't in the day-to-day of the business, it actually enabled for the business to be in a much better position to be sold as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when we had the tech leaders in there, their screen literally looked like the Matrix with numbers and codes coming down. The thing is, it has screensaver, are you doing something? He's like, no, I'm building it. I'm like, are you? God, I don't know anything about this. But it meant that you're going to have an outside voice go, yeah, no, you're focusing on building something cool, but you're not thinking about why we're doing it.
Yeah.
And so we were able to use the whole network of people we knew through architecture to test case it.
So perfect.
If they weren't going to use it, and we had to change the model a few times, or we had to make it free for a while, which we all were like, oh God, like we might never
because tech is so expensive as a business. It's so expensive to build, particularly if you're actually building a proper piece of software. Yeah. It's sort of like people don't, I always think about it when you go and talk about tech and it's like, oh, it'll cost like, that's come down now. You can probably build quite a bit by yourself. We'll go into that with AI.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like a $200,000 build and it's like, then it has to be constantly maintained. I think, God, you know, you think about building and building, it takes a lot to build it, but then it's not a continuous high turnover. So that's when everybody thinks tech is like this fancy thing, but really it is solving a problem that is, you start at one point and you realize that actually what we thought wasn't, people are going to change it, the market is going to tell us. And I think that's why when you talk to people who are in tech industry, they think a little bit more like that. Like, you know, they have a lot of accelerators. They think a lot because they really do have to test product market fit. Is it, do that? Because otherwise it doesn't stack up as a business. Is that what you found as well?
100%. Like, I suppose the underlying role from the architecture background is that people come to us because they have a problem and they think we can do it better than they can. Now, you have that magic consultant thing. You go, why bring me in if you're not going to listen to what I say? But everyone gets that. But the concept of whatever we did is that we'd have all our tech people, they'd build up the platform, but then they would lose sight of what the actual problem was because they didn't deal with it day to day. So everything we always did was, well, what's the actual problem? They said, okay, well, let's think about it. Be solutions-based. Don't move the problem around the table and point fingers, but work out what the problem is and we'll solve it. How it happened will become a lot more irrelevant as you go on. So that was why us as the founders were really key to it, because we actually understood, well, if I was using this, it wouldn't work. So you can have this cool thing off to the side, but it doesn't matter. It's pointless. So we managed to build that up and got, I reckon we dodged the change in the tech market by 3 weeks.
Really?
And even the CEO who sold it, and he's still the CEO now, he said, we were very lucky. Yes, 3 weeks later, things changed and I don't reckon we would have sold it.
So when did you sell it? Because it's been going for a few years now.
It was ironically about the time, which I'll get to with the health stuff, was about the time that changed our take on that a little bit. We'd started the process, but then I got sick and I said, look, my deliverables have changed a bit. I have to think about what is good for my family, what I need for the family, and I kind of need to sell this. Like, I'm not putting pressure on it, but it changed. It changed the dynamic of how we did it.
Because it
just pushed it a bit quicker. More the emphasis of like, no, let's not argue too hard what the number is. If it's a good number, I got to tell you, I don't know how I'm going to go.
So yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I don't have the luxury of this. So, and I can get to that bit whenever you're ready. But that was a big define. If you talk about uncomfortable, that's about as uncomfortable as I've ever been. Is when I got sick. And so a description someone said to me, go, you have to get used to the new version of you and be comfortable being uncomfortable.
Would you want to talk about that and what happened? You're welcome to or not to.
Yeah, no. I'm very open about it. So towards the end of that 14 or 15 years, to be honest, I was probably burnt out. Like a lot of people, you're running a business. And there's only two directors and two rainmakers feeding 60 people.
That's a very high ratio.
That's a lot.
That's a 1-to-30 ratio. Yeah.
We had an advisory group of older heads who, and that was one of the things in red was always succession plan. What's your succession plan? I said, we don't need one. We're fine. And he's like, well, you say that. And then, but it's going to come. And it's
quite funny. People just don't necessarily think about it. Because obviously I talk to a lot, work with a lot of architects. I find the engineers, they're always about build, sell. That's their model because they've got so many international companies that can buy them out. Whereas architects, you know, 75 to, you know, depends on which city, around 83% are actually under size of 10, let's say. Yeah. If you look at how many firms there are that are actually multi-generational, there's not that many. And then there's this part of, and we can talk about when we get to your advisory side, but then there's this part of, is it actually a good deal for the next generation coming in? Because
There's some antiquated methods that's still there. Mm. And I think there's a real age group of who are running a lot of those embedded firms, and that's changing. But I don't think the next tier actually understand what's involved in running it.
Yeah, absolutely.
They see the upside but not the downside.
Well, and that is one of the things. A lot of people sort of see people running a company, right? And they think, oh, and they go out for coffees and they do all this and they just seem to, you know, live a bit of a more of a high life. But actually, that person's thinking about the cash flow. How many projects have we got in?
Every day.
How much have we got in the bank? What is that going to mean? How many payrolls have we actually got out? If they don't pay this invoice, if that project goes on hold, particularly for project-orientated companies. And I think what happens is this, and this is obviously what we do in our business, you know, helping people that evolution within their development, but also their succession plans on multiple fronts, you know. Yeah. One is also having more people to be able to do, and it is like, you know, one of our businesses is a recruitment business, but we don't necessarily do it in the old contingent way. It's one of the things that we do. But if you run a contingent business, the reason a recruitment firm works so well is you literally have that many salespeople. They're constantly doing activity, constantly calling. And so that is where the return comes. They might have a database, might have all of that, but their constant activity is actually what makes those businesses quite profitable because they're like real estate and just a whole team of salespeople. But if you look at that from an architecture firm or a PM firm or an engineering firm, you're talking about like 5%. We generally talk about when we're looking for, you know, people in architecture who will want a BD or do that, they are 5%. And then they go, well, why would I do it for somebody else when I could do it for myself? Yeah, and I can create it in my image. I mean, the costs now are so high and insurances and the tech costs for it. And that's one of the hardest things is how you bring people up and you do it. And I think that's one of the interesting conversations we're going to have of you've gone on to the advisory. You obviously had a health situation that may have changed you within that. But now in your advisory, I'm sure you're working with people, as we spoke about, and helping them to realize, I mean, you've started how many businesses have you been involved in now? At least 5 different businesses. We'll go through that a bit more. Yep. And that's what I call entrepreneur, looking at that and the opportunities versus starting one business and continuing that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you at Leaf Run, we had Land Checker running at the same time. We also did probably 7 of our own developments.
Yeah, right.
It was really interesting and we knew how to do it. And everyone wants to do that, but it's not as easy as people think. And it's certainly hard now. So we probably had 3 businesses running at once, but each of those developments was its own entity and you've got to manage all these processes with it. We liked doing all of it, but it did – I remember we let our senior workers into the numbers and stuff more and they're like, oh God, I can see that you guys must think about so much stuff all day. I said, yeah, like the jobs are just the jobs, but how we manage and cash flow, exactly as you said before, cash flow, how we're paying for this. Like if you all want new computers, that's great. How am I getting that money to pay for you all at once? I can't because I can do it in 2 months and 3 of you and there's a whole process. But when you've got 60 people,
I've grown a firm from 90 to 200, and I can tell you, and it just, people don't think about those things.
And you're no, they don't. And it's even less so now. And I think we'll touch on that soon, but I part of the reason I do the advisory stuff, and advisory is just a term I came up with. It's a very corporate term. It's not really consultant, all those words are very corporate, but I didn't know what else to call it. I didn't even want to put my name on it either, but they said, well, but your story is really important. So if it's not you, how will they know it's you?
Yeah.
So that, to give that some relevance, the I found out by chance that I had a brain tumor that I didn't know about. I was driving home from a friend's house at night, and I just felt a bit dizzy, and I never had headaches, any of that stuff. So I pulled over the car for a second, and I woke up in the car like 5 hours late, like just as though you'd gone to sleep in the sun type thing. Yeah. And I just panicked with that because I thought that can't be good. And I went to the GP the next day. I told my wife, because it was like 2 a.m. by then. And I just rang my wife. And everyone said, why didn't your wife wake up when you went there? I go, oh, she's a deep sleeper. She didn't know I wasn't there. And but we went to the GP the next day. And I still think I'm very lucky the GP I had. Because GP, you know, the general practitioner, they don't know. And she said, well, I might just get you to go. And I'd had, actually, let me go back a step. I'd had the second Pfizer injection the day before. So it was in the middle of COVID.
Oh, God, and Jesus.
A lot of people had like, oh, God, I got wiped out. I had to be in bed all day. I was like, oh, right, it might have just got me. I don't know. I don't know how this stuff works. And I said, told that to GP. She said, yeah, we do see a bit of that. She said, but the dizziness thing is a bit different. We might just get you to do an MRI. And I was like, yeah, no problem. Or whatever. I felt tired, but I was fine, sort of thing, or in my head, fine. And so went and had the MRI, and then I went to the market, the South Melbourne Market with the kids and stuff, and they rang me back quite quickly and said, you better come back in. I said, oh, why? They said, because there's something there. Went, oh, okay. And so you go into the, and they said, they put it up on the screen, it's super clear. There's a golf ball sized tumor in the front left side of my brain.
Oh, that's, I know somebody, right. Somebody close to me had the same thing. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And I said, oh. And so then they just dive straight into the realities of it. Yeah. And so we're sitting there, my wife and I are sitting there kind of just looking at it. And they said, well, now we're going to have to do some more tests and MRIs or test this, but you're probably going to have it out and do this. And we're like, Jesus, like, what does this mean? And they said, well, the reality is we think it's a type 2 glioma. I said, okay, what does that mean? And so, well, type 1 is generally you have an operation, you get it out, and generally you're okay. Type 2, it's a slow burner. And I said, what? So it's going to get me? And they said, traditionally, yeah. It's a weed. And they had an example. They said, take a handful of black sand, throw it on a beach, and then go and pick up all that black sand. I said, you won't be able to because it's there. You just can't.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And I said, right. And so I said, what are you talking about? And they said, well, traditionally, it's about 10 to 15 years and it'll get you. I'm like, right. And I'm pretty pragmatic. Like, I'm sort of okay with
luckily.
Me. Wife, though, it's a disaster. Like she has a real thing about, you know, growing old with me and things like that. And I said, but that, you know, this is 4 years ago. So we're talking,
yeah,
you know, and I said, look, the first 2 years are no picnic. And I can't imagine the last year is a walk in the park either. So I'm not succumbed to that time frame yet, but it was a very, very real conversation.
Mm.
And it threw everything upside down. So I had the first operation. I also said I had to be awake for the operation, which I didn't know was a thing.
Yeah, which I've heard before.
I said, why do I have to be awake? They said, because it's near the speech bit in your brain. And I said, so well, what do you mean? And they said, well, we're just going to keep cutting away. He said, what, until I start slurring? They're like, kind of, yeah. I'm like, well, how do you know if you cut too far? And they said, that's why you're going to be awake. We're going to ask you questions and we'll work it out. I'm like,
well, so not only you're awake, you're having to, did you actually see it? Because I know I had a blood clot and they put the thing up and I could see it going up my vein and that. Was
no, but I
could, enough, but
I had one eye kind of covered, and then the anesthesiologist brings you in. He's like, "So how's work going?" I'm like, "What?" And I go, "Oh, it's all right. I think I don't know." And I can
really.
Hear the doctor doing stuff.
Because of course you would hear everything. You would hear drilling into your brain.
You just feel like you have this thing pinned to you, so you can't move. But I was just awake and I was like, oh, work's all right, I guess. I don't know. And he goes, oh, he's fine. Like, his speech is fine. Because they said to me, I said, the scar, it goes from here all the way there. Like, it's enormous. And I remember thinking,
take off, if you don't mind me asking, because I also had a friend who had an aneurysm, and they took off his whole part of his skull, and then they put it back on, and then they've got all metal in it as well.
There's no metal in it, but they took the skull off. They took a big chunk of the skull off to get it. They said, because they said, look, if you got skin cancer, we cut all around it and get all the tech. We can't do that with your brain or you'll be all over the place. I said, so we took, but what I underestimated, because I only came out on Panadol, but no painkillers, no nothing. And I said, why is that? And I said, because there's no nerve endings in your brain. It's only the skin on your head. Once you open up, you don't feel a thing. So I said, when you're operating your brain, there's no painkillers in it because you don't need it. So it's when I came out, I was just like, and you're under for 3 hours. I was in hospital for 3 days. That's it. And you're out. And so that the first time I came out, and I thought you'd, so you speak to the neurosurgeon, and they're very blunt, and they're amazing mechanics. They said there's this whole team of people that help you out in the background. That is not necessarily the case. And I had to find out that you have to do the work to learn about it the hard way and do it for yourself. Now, I thought I'd get more, but you walk out, someone said, what did they give you? Nothing.
I must say I had a very similar situation when I had a medical, and I was like, I had to go and Google what some intern had said, because it's fascinating. It's like amazing, you are just on a wheel, and it's like, oh yeah, this. And then I worked in medical colleges for a while, and it's like, it's kind of just the way where you're just like, okay, right. It doesn't help you at all.
Nah. And there's the neurosurgeon did three of those operations that day, like three brain, and she's a gun. But I know I had to go back in about 2 months later and have a repeat version because it had grown, because that's the concept. It keeps growing. It's like it's literally like a weed. So when you pull the weeds out, it doesn't mean they're not there. You just can't see.
Did they, if you don't mind me asking, this gets in a bit scientist for me, but do they burn it, or do you do chemo or radiation
it? They cut it out, but then they took that and they gave it to, so I was at Royal Melbourne in Cup. Yeah. Behind that is an institute called WEHI, which is Walter and Elizabeth Institute. It's a brain cancer centre.
Yeah, right.
And so after the first operation, my wife knew Carrie Bickmore's husband at the time. They're now not together. And she saw him on the beach and she said, oh, my husband now has what Carrie's first husband died from. I have the exact same thing that he did.
Yeah.
And so she was on the beach and he said, oh, she'd love to talk to him. So I spoke to Carrie for about 2 hours on the beach. And she said, I've got to introduce you to the CEO of the Brain Cancer Centre. Like, you've got to.
And that's where you work now. You're involved with him as well.
I met him and he's an amazing guy. I really like him. He used to work at Cotton On. He helped them make the beanies. He gets upset when he's talking about it. I said, oh, have you lost someone? He said, no, I just see it. I see it every day. And they have this amazing business. And if you talk about balance, that's the thing that keeps me grounded, is whenever I get too busy with something, work, and then I'm part of Professor Misty Jenkins' research team as a consumer, which basically just means patient voice. And you're there. I get to watch what they're doing, and it's extraordinary. And so you see these group of researchers, and they're all young. They all look like bloody models. I don't know what it is, but all these guys and girls who love it. They don't get paid well. They're doing something that is going to change our lives dramatically. And brain cancer kills so many kids. It's extraordinary. And people don't know it. I didn't know enough about it. But they are doing this every day. And you just see, you come out of there when you do something for it and you're like, I feel so much better. That's what makes a difference. And so a big driver I have is that I don't forget that stuff, because I did. When you have a craniotomy, which they call it, they say you're never the same person after that. Every single person has it is never the same. And they don't know what it is. It's different for everyone because the brain reacts differently.
Mm-hmm.
I became coiled up like a spring. I'd snap at the kids. And I considered myself very calm, and I wasn't. I was like this. And I hated that. And I remember my daughter, who is, she's 9 now. She would have been, 5 or something like that. And I was just... I was harsh and it just wasn't me. And I remember saying, oh, do you want to go over there, do something? She says, no. And I said, do you want to go in the other room? She says, no. I said, so do you not want to be alone with me? And she said, no. I'm like, oh, all right. And I told my wife, she goes, that is heartbreaking. I said, I know it's just at the moment. And I said, I know that's what I need to change. And that's why I stepped away from you at Leaf. It's a big driver, is like, if I don't get healthy, it's all irrelevant.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. What's the point of working?
And whilst I must say, I mean, nobody would wish that on anybody, what you're going through, and you obviously have enormous strength and it must be exceptionally difficult for your family through those times as well. And one of the things that you've obviously noted is that you've learnt more about yourself in the last 4 years than you have in the last 20 years. And obviously that's made fundamental differences to where you are today and what you're doing. So do you want to tell us about then what you've gone on to create and to do now?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I learnt a lot, not all good things, to be honest. Like you learnt that I was not living particularly healthily, just work too much work and just lose focus of what's kind of important. And then when I had a conversation with my daughter, you realize, oh, what's the point in doing that stuff? And so I think I had stopped loving what I was doing. I think it was just an element of burnout. So, and then I spent 2 years kind of trying to find my feet. You know, am I an architect? No, I'm not at U at Leaf. What am I? If I'm not U at Leaf, what am I? I don't really know. And so it was only about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, that I said, I was just sitting around waiting for something to happen or someone to do it for me or something like that. And I was like, you know what? I can't do that. Like, life's too short to do that. And so I stopped doing so. Like, I don't drink anymore. I've turned that off completely, not because I had an issue with it, but it's just my emotional response to things are not the same as they were before. That's one of those changes.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I need to wake up clarity.
And how did you find that, by the way? Obviously, you've gone through everything. I gave it up for a year and I absolutely loved it. And now I've gone back on and I go, can I just give it up? But
I've actually found it fine. But I think it's very different giving it up at 47 than it would have been at 23. So I can't guarantee I would have had the discipline then. But now I know that there's and the game has changed in the drinking world. Like 18-year-olds aren't drinking like us. It's too expensive. And so zero beers are everywhere. And I didn't think about zero beers. My wife said, why don't you drink zero beers? I said, well, I don't want to drink it like that all day. And she said, it's not for you. It's for the people you're with. And he said, you can't order a quick every time. You're not four. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. And so I had the zero beers. And so everyone watches you have a beer with them. They don't feel weird and they pour it in a glass and you're part of it.
Yeah, and it has really changed. And I took that whole year off. I even had my 20-year anniversary and that, and I had no problems. I would do soda water. I started my business that year because I knew I needed to build. And people were like, oh, and I was like, well, we're very fortunate that we can, we can go and do this. My favorite beer now is actually, and I buy it anyway, is Nort's. I just love them. Yeah. They're a really good pale ale. I think they're great. I don't think they're pale ale, but they're an ale. It's fundamentally better, and I feel better when I'm not drinking. But I mean, those sort of changes. So that was a little one, right?
That was a little one. Yep. I knew that I wanted to help other people grow their business. I just didn't really know in what aspect. And then a friend of mine, Jane Merrilies, who's got her own activity, she said, oh, would you speak at something? I've got something coming up with a couple of other people. And I said, oh, about what? She said, oh, small to business firms and how to kind of navigate the decision. Like, yeah, for sure. And I spoke for it and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. And I had all these people reach out after. There's four or five architecture people who said, can you help us? Ironically, they're all similar age. They're all in their 40s. And I think everyone's got to their 40s and they looked at what I spoke about and I spoke about getting sick. And they said, we're looking down the road. It's getting harder and architecture is getting harder. It's getting more of a grind and all the industries are and they're all saying the same thing and that forecasting is really hard. But they said, oh, I realize if I'm mid-40s and my kids are getting to a certain age, I don't want to do this till I'm 80. Like, I don't want to be just grinding for what? I need to find some other source of income. I need to find other people. I need a succession plan. I've never thought about it before, but I can see the urgency of it now. I said, yeah, I didn't think like that either. And I think I said to you before that very ironically that getting sick and having to step away from U at Leaf has probably made me a better person than I realized I needed to be. And so I sort of stepped into U at Advisory and in the year and a half, and it can't be a coincidence, in the year and a half that I haven't been drinking, I've started the company, put the website up, started an off co-working office called 2.5, which I said before, it's called 2.5 because I only want to be in here 2.5 days and that's it.
Which I love. And as you said, the other people in it are the same. Like, you know, you want to go in and connect with people, but, you know, live the rest of your life or, you know, have the flexibility, I'm assuming. Is that the sort of
Yeah, drive? Exactly. And they're all sort of some of the local parents, but they're all guys who've got really cool businesses and really interesting stuff that I'm still learning more about. One of the guys is now becoming my advisor to help me bounce off. It's a good space, but I needed it from a mental health point too. Like working at home, I was like, can't do it, but I'm not getting anything done. And so I came in here and it was an opportunity. It's just around the corner. And I never thought I'd run a co-working office, that's for sure. Some of the things I didn't even know you're meant to do, but I really like it. And so I got that going and a website for that. Then leaning into is always an element sitting on my shoulder of helping the Brain Cancer Center and helping WeHive with that. And that I will never be able to let that go because they help me. Mm-hmm. I can also see how much of a problem it is, and it's something that changed my life upside down. Upside down from what it used to be. I don't do any design anymore. That's a strange thing. And I only kind of came to terms with that a little while ago. But I now know the advisory stuff from people say, can you help me grow my business? Can you help me be more resilient? Yeah. Yes, I can. But I know how to do it, but I'm not going to do it for you. I'm not going to rescue you. I'm going to give you the processes that I've learned over time. And my instinct was, yeah, do this. And now I'm learning that, no. I want to teach you how to do it.
Yeah, do it with you, not for you.
Do it with you, not for you. And I didn't quite get that right at the start. And so the last 2 years, I feel like it's all opened up. But then, you know, I even had a meeting this morning with a client. They're worried that they had a business partner. I'm not sure if it aligns. I said, it's okay if it doesn't. Like there's no wrong answer, and it's okay if you have to go in a different direction, but everyone's gut feeling is that, well, I can't because I failed. Yeah. No, it's not like that. Like you have to adapt.
And it is very interesting because people don't realize that you start something, a business becomes, you have to put so much into it. My mother ran a business for 40 years, definitely her identity as well, and it becomes part of you because it's like literally you're entering a competition nobody else is aware of, that you are in survival mode and you're doing and you're thinking, and you're the person who goes to bed thinking about it. You're the person who has to look at the bank account all the time. You're the person who's thinking about everything that's ahead. What's the reputation? What's the quality? Because it's your business, particularly if you put your name on it as well. It's everything has that element. And particularly obviously for architects, generally you do it. You know, we always ask people why architecture at the beginning, and the majority of the answers are because there's just nothing. I just always wanted to be. I played with Lego. I liked art, science, different mixture of answers. But it's because it is a profession, passion. It isn't necessarily paid, you know, as well as other professions. And I know because I work with everybody and I'm like, Jesus Christ. You know, you think, you know, you get some people in some professions, so I go, want this money. You realize that's more than most partners are getting paid in architecture firms, but you can't really tell them that as a mid to senior person. And then people work so hard, and it is hard because it's not like, even if you're running an accounting firm or a law firm, it is a bit, there's more cyclical cycles. Maybe law is a bit different, but definitely for anybody working in the built environment, the problem is you think something's on, you might have a project and it's worth a mil or 2 mil or it's worth 500 or whatever it is, depending on the size, and it goes on hold. Yeah. Or it can't stack up, or it doesn't go past DA, or suddenly everybody has to make a decision to do that. And it is a very stressful. But because people obviously link the design and what is actually done also to the business, it's a very interesting part where that identity, I think, is even more than most other business owners. It does very much link to it. But you'd gone and done other things. And as you said, kind of going through this massive change in your life has turned it upside down. But a lot of people never go through that. We always think that we've got forever and we've got all of this time. When if actually somebody told us when our day was up, I really wonder how we would all live our lives differently and we approach it. And that's when you talk about problem solving. Every one of us is in control of our lives. It's a lot of the time it's just about perspective of what we do and the drive to necessarily change that and take control.
Definitely. you know, I live around the corner. I live in Albert Park, and, you know, it's a very expensive area. We don't own a house anymore, but you grapple with that, oh, but I'm supposed to own it.
Like,
why? Well, I don't know. You just meant to. Whereas I grapple with the concept of freedom, because if someone say, what do you want your legacy to be? And so it's not work. Like, the kids like the work kind of, but they don't really care either. You underestimate what they care about. But I mean, making memories with them, like, you know what it's like with the kids who go, you take them on a holiday, it costs a lot, and all they remember is how good the buffet was in one of the hotels. Like, damn it, you know, we went and saw something really cool, don't you? And they're like, oh, I don't remember. So making the memories of stuff, that's the key. So if I can do something that I love doing, but help money build up so that we can at any point go and do stuff if something changes, because I don't know. I have an MRI every 6 months, and you have what they call scanxiety, is a terrible word, but it's accurate. That week before, a few days between we have MRI and you get the results, they're not good. It's like you just...
Oh, it'd be horrible.
And I actually had a couple of seizures just at Christmas, just gone in my sleep. I've never had them before. And there was nothing. I was looking after myself or just whatever. And my father passed away towards the end of the year. That might have had an impact on it, even though I don't carry grief for that in that sense, but it might have been something like that. But a number of other sort of just life. But I felt like I'd been hit by a truck. My body was so sore. My tongue was torn up because I'd been rubbing on my teeth or whatever. It was in my sleep. And I've had about 2 weeks where I was like, oh, God, I'm no good. Like, I couldn't remember what year it was and all sorts of shit. And they said, you're more prone to seizures because of having the bit of your brain out. And I said, right. And I said, so they said, there's no reason. I said, not particularly. You just have to be aware of what your capacities are.
Mm.
I get tired more easily. If I get a little bit tired, I can get really tired. So I work to constraints that I set for myself, because I know that it's not worth getting to the point of that, because having one more meeting doesn't matter. But, you know,
I think whilst that's very, very, you know, difficult to go through, it is one of those things that a lot of entrepreneurs, so I'm quite fortunate, I live on the Gold Coast, and we had this conversation the other day. I saw this post and I was like, oh, the Melbourne life and all that. And we had this conversation with a friend, and, you know, we're talking about schools and what schools are teaching children these days and what our role is as parents to do that. But I said, I think the fundamental difference of where I live on the Gold Coast is that there's not many jobs. So you really have to run a business if you want to do things. And it means you're surrounded by a bunch of people who think like entrepreneurs. And the entrepreneur, you've probably got that in your co-working space as well that you see.
Definitely.
So whilst you've had to learn through health, a lot of other people are also approaching that freedom and that constraints. And I think what the side of that is that often people think, I've got to work 8 12-hour days, right? Yeah. Versus what's the leverage, and this is probably a good pathway to us talking about the opportunities of future, what's the leverage? If I had restricted time and I actually did, how much can I get done in this time? How would I approach that problem differently? How would I run my business differently if I only gave myself 2.5 days? Right, let's say, because of your business, but let's say it was 5-hour days or 3 and 5 or whatever the situation is. Do you think that has you noticed that, and that's something that you work with people in your advisory business on?
Definitely, definitely. You know, it's something I deliberately do. I say, you know, why don't you work five days? Because I don't want to. I want to have at least a day and a half that I do stuff with the kids, and I coach my son's footy team and I do these things. And some people don't get to do that stuff. And you think you're going to get to do it later. That's what everyone's mindset is. I'll do it when I'm older and I've got time. They go, yeah, but then they don't want to hang out with you. It's nothing to do with you. They have their own lives. When they're 11 to and under, you're still the most important person in your life. You know, I could tell complete lies to my children. They'd think it was absolute truth because you're the single source of information.
Yeah, well, I've got 4 and 5, so I know I've got that to about 11 or 12, and then my life is...
Then they're like, see you later. But it's, you know, what I've worked out is that you can get a lot done when you're focused and you enjoy what you're doing. When you're caught up in stuff that is really burning you out, you tend to not be able to navigate through the stuff that's important. So, you know, I don't drink anymore. So people said, what's your offset? I said, it's actually change of pace or change in scenery. So if we go and do something, I step away for a couple of days, I come and go, I know what I'm doing. Whereas no one does it. And so I can see the difference. It's not quantity, it's quality. So if you do 5 hours of good work, and people stay, you know, I'm up till 11, go, you're not working well. You just
no.
You're not.
I had that conversation with a friend the other day because my elder youngest has just started school, and I thought, oh yeah, I'm not going to get childcare, and we got childcare after school care, and then he turned around and said, I don't want to go to childcare, like have massive anxiety attacks with it. Now it's suddenly like, okay, I have to change my entire life. And I was running a business at the time, partners working full time. And it was like, okay, well, so I have to sacrifice. And it was very funny for the first few, I was like, had a bit of a heart attack. And then I was like, look, if I just give myself 5 hours, what can I achieve in 5 hours? How do I run my day differently? What does that actually look like? I've still had to, I'm struggling. I've had to go back to eight for a bit. There's a few things, but what it makes you do, and I had a friend doing this for years, she works, you know, she might work different hours and different things, but she tries to finish up by 3:30. And she's been running businesses for 10 plus years. But it is, I've realized, because it is about efficiency and really just scaling down to what are things that matter. And I think the hardest thing, as you said, is that when you are running something like a professional services or an architecture firm, and I do see leaders do this, is they are listening to 60 people's problems, right? But if you do it in the old, I'm sure you talk about this in your advisory, the sort of 1-to-5-to-7 ratio, that is where we get hierarchical structures into that. Nothing more than that. It's just one person can't take on 60 people's problems. Think about the cash flow. Be out there BDing every day. Be doing this, be doing that. There is a point that no matter how good your health is, that you are going to burn out. And we live a faster life than we've ever lived in our lives. The pace of which we work, I mean, God, like most people, I turn all mine off and tell people to do that, you know, have their notifications, I'll be sitting in a meeting and then something comes up. I'm like, you don't realize what that's doing to your brain and the stress it's causing to your body, your cortisol levels. So I think, you know, we look at this and we've never had a time where people are more stressed. We've never had a time where people are working harder. Now, I'm going to say that in general terms, we live in the best time in history civilization. Sure. Let's be clear on that. But if you look at, you know, how we're working, we're sedentary, sitting, we're doing all of these things. And I find architects do that. And it's quite funny when I first go into firms, I've done this one before, and there's a kind of culture of, oh, we have to work 12 hours. And I've said to everybody, just if you work 12 hours, this is what's going to happen. You're going to get really tired. Those last few hours, you're not cognitively going to be working very well. Your brain is not going to be working. So what that's actually going to do on the fee is that you're now going to work 4 hours. Then you're going to get 5 hours sleep. Then you're going to come in and you're going to do that for 4 or 5 months. The quality of your work is going to go down.
Yep.
And this is, you know, that's to them, but this is to the business. So actually what we want people to do is to, and sometimes, you know, people talk about that, and sometimes you have to work late. But it's where that squeeze sort of comes in. What are some of the tips and tricks that you talk to some of your clients or you've found to help firms within kind of changing that mentality, a very, you know, very low fees, lots of things on, time is getting less and the pressures are getting more and the fees are getting less?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think something comes down to generations too. Like, the bosses often work a lot because they're doing things that, are, you know, you finish, you get to 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you have to actually start doing your work because you've been helping everyone else all day. And so there's still this undercurrent of, if they're still here, I better still be here. Like, it's this competitive thing. And architects are quite bad at staying there till the hours, and they love doing what they're doing, but they're also burnt out. And so, you know, I used to have a lot of discussions, and I still do now, with like, well, how are all your people? And they said, but they don't work fast enough. I said, just because they don't work as fast as the other person, it doesn't mean they're not doing as good a job. They just don't work as fast. So if you have certain roles and understand your people, so you have to understand how they all work. We used to kind of have a rule, by 6:30, you got to go home. Nothing as good is going to happen.
Yeah.
Unless there's some extraordinary kind of outlier where you have to do it. You're no good to us. The keyboard warriors don't work anymore. So don't come in and cough. Just go, just look after yourself as well. And that's my biggest driver now, is like, you have to be okay as well. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how hard you work, because you'll fall over.
Well, and I think the other thing is that meetings seem to be the thing everybody...
Meetings.
And I have a rule that I don't with, you know, I generally have had to change things around, but I have a rule. I generally didn't do meetings until 12. Now it's 11 because, you know, it's between 11 and 2:30. Yep. And that's just because you need those first few hours. And I think that's one of the things a lot of organizations need to consider is we don't do meetings before this time. And it's okay. It's okay, yeah, you know, right. You'll figure that out, whether it's with clients, if you're doing it that way. You know, generally the first 2 hours of a senior person's day is getting on the phone, having a chat to people anyway, because, you know, all the end of the day. So we do know those parts come in. But I think when I see people burnt out, I often look at, okay, let's look at what's actually happening. Let's look at the habits that you've got internally. Let's look at your personal habits of what you're doing. And boundaries is actually okay. Because if we actually put in boundaries, it actually helps us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a – I mean, we talk about there's lots of problems, but it's actually – the architecture is a really cool industry. Like, it's fun, and you get to – you talked about earlier why do people do it. It's because you get a trophy at the end. You say, I designed that. That's why. And so people go,
you're
I want
so
to
– so lucky. Yeah.
I get to see that at the end. I get to show people that's what I did. You know, so, you know, when I talk about – and I spend a lot of time – teaching people how to put in processes in place and be transparent with what you're doing. And I said, that's something we did right at Hewitt Leaves that I think we helped everyone see what we're doing and how we're running. And it's like, it's not us telling you, it's us together. What do you think? One of the big sort of underlying things I said to people is to just be really authentic. Like, if you present something to me and you don't believe it, I'll see it straight away. And I said, if you don't believe it, how am I going to believe it? And so there was a good saying I heard that people say, you know, there's a famous saying, you know, be real, like be real in your answer. So well, it's easy to be real for a little bit. So just stay real, like actually be really consistent in what you do. And if you want to go home because you want to pick up your kids 3 times a week and you say, I'm going to pick up my kids, I'm not budging on that. If people don't respect that to a certain degree, then that's not the right approach either. Like they say, you got to work for me and you got to bust your balls. I don't care if your family falls apart. I don't think that's sustainable. And so I understand that that's a very black and white comment. When we kind of live in the gray, but I think if you put those things in place as a director, you go, I'm coming in 9:30 2 days a week because I'm taking my son to school because I get to talk to him in the car. Otherwise, I don't get to talk. And so those things are really important.
Well, I've been quite fortunate, obviously, working in national organisations. And you can see you might have one organisation, but each studio is different.
Yeah.
Because it depends on the leaders who are in that. And it's often the leaders who do that. They do... You know, people who are maybe in their 20s don't fully get it. And then when they get to their 30s and 40s, they'll get it pretty quickly and go, oh, God, that's a great example that they gave. But it is about, it's no different to, you know, we don't just do it that it just has to be parents. We also advocate whether it's a sport or that balance in your life will make you more productive and better outcomes. And, I mean, it does get particularly difficult when you are a parent and you're trying to balance all of that. You go home, you've got a second job. Right. So, and in essence, the kids don't care what you did, what happened, work today. No. There was a design, don't care. And work doesn't care about what the kids is going on, right? At the same time. But it is about then empowering for people to make those boundaries and do that. Look, let's, we could talk for hours, right? I'm just looking at the time already. Let's talk a little bit about the opportunities that you see and some of the challenges. So, obviously, we know right now, you know, there is already a construction problem. It's very costly. I just spoke to a tradesperson this morning who already told me that their costs have gone up 30% in the last week.
Yeah.
You know, I know plumbers who were talking about that even the silicon and everything they're going to put together, that's going to go up. Obviously, we're right in the middle of an oil crisis right now. But we also then, you know, you're based in Melbourne. Melbourne's obviously the market. You're working with developers as well. As you said, I don't know if it's online or offline, that, you know, development is getting harder. So I've listed a few of those things, but what do you feel are some of the challenges? And then let's talk about some of the opportunities, because with challenges, there's always opportunities.
Yeah, definitely. You're exactly right. It's getting harder. Like it's across the board that people are a little bit more gun shy with spending their money. Because the cost of living is going up and construction costs are going up and they're not going to come down again.
I think that's the hardest thing.
That's what everyone's saying. They're not going to come back down again. Because we were living in a world where it was everyone could make money from it. Like 7 years ago, everyone made money from it. Everyone's still making it. The smart people who've got big banks and deep pockets, they're just treading water and going, because it will come up again. Like everyone will start money again, but they just have to tread water through this. And there's a lot of people who are getting to the point for the first time probably going, this might be too hard. I might have to step away from this and do something different. And we talked about it earlier off screen, say, you know, AI at the moment is moving so fast. And I think it's really cool. I'm really interested in it. I'm learning a lot about it because architects aren't very, there's rendering and stuff, but then actually how they're making their business better. So as much as work is harder managing it, it's actually a really cool opportunity to show why problem solvers are even more important than ever. So
yeah,
I think where the job market will change, people's jobs, some will disappear. That's the reality. Like, you know, I hate to say it, but some if you don't have strong admin people and that something can be automated, it will get automated quickly. And in the last 6 months, it's been drastically quicker. And that's really cool for a business owner, scary for if you're in that role. However, it exposes the need for senior, even mid-level kind of smart critical thinking, someone who can put all those pieces of the puzzle together, because AI doesn't tell you the answer. It just gives you information. And that information is skewed sometimes.
Well, and you, as we say, as somebody else said the other day, and you hear it like rubbish in, rubbish out sometimes as well. You kind of got to know. But I think it's a bit like, and that's the interesting thing, because you've come from a tech background. You've already built stuff using tech. You know that the tech's just about like putting the blocks in, right? It's how they're programmed and how the architecture's done in the background to build it. But then it's actually what's the end user? What are we trying to get out of that? And I think this is the phase everybody's in at the moment of what can it actually do? Right. Yeah. So LLMs have come in and done that. But now, like, you know, what I know that some people are doing and friends are doing is incredible. Like building entire websites, doing all of this stuff.
In a day.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've built our own software as well and to run all of those processes, because the same thing. It's like, what is it that you do? Where is those value points? What can be automated? What's the value to the person that you're helping as well? Yep. So definitely from a business operations point of view, AI has definitely helped. And again, there's different ones, and I think it is that some people are scratching on the surface. You know, we were contacted about doing some AI training. I was like, how are people not learning this? And it's like, because they actually also don't have the time. And I noticed a recent post by you of actually allocating time to do it. And I had this interesting conversation on the weekend. I've got a friend who's got multiple businesses, and, you know, they had thought about, they feel like from the work that we've been doing that they've been missing out a little bit on it. And they went, we've realized as founders that we, and as the executive leaders, we actually probably need to get into it and understand it. And it is that part, because you've got two parts. You can't necessarily, you know, if you're trying to run a professional services business, fully step away and get your head fully into it, because it does take quite a while. You've got to understand, if you come from more of a tech element, you'll understand it. But then it is that, now I've got that myself too. I'm like, well, how much do I keep going on with it? And how much does our assistants do that? And they've got, or I'll take it to one point, and then when you start to hand it off, then it goes to somebody else.
You're exactly right. Like most architects particularly, and I only talk about them because I know it well, but if you have to make something that looks like it's got a dramatic time frame to do it, everyone says, I don't have time. We'll just see what they do and we'll do that later. But AI moves so fast. If someone says, why don't you learn AI? It's good. By the time I've learned that platform, it won't be the platform I'm supposed to use anymore.
Yeah.
Like we've got a guy in the office here he's got a tech business, but he's got a property background. And I had something on ChatGPT on the screen. He goes, are you still using ChatGPT? I go, what show? He goes, use Claude. Claude is way quicker. And I'm starting to get across it. But you could almost argue that everyone needs a tech advisor in their company to stay ahead or stay on top of this stuff and give you updates. Because otherwise it moves so fast. We're the biggest validation era of this stuff. Like our kids will go, do you know they used to hold the phones next to their face while they talked into it? And they had it in their pocket, like next to all their bits. And like, that's the most stupidest thing I've ever heard. I'm like, I know. So I think AI, it's scary. And unfortunately, the media is probably scaring everyone with it a little bit, but it's going to be one of the best tools for business that we've ever had. It's just about how to use it.
And I think that's it. I mean, so I think we're now at the early, we're past the early adopter stage, and we're now getting into that the mass sort of stages where people are doing it. But I mean, I talk to architecture firms every day, right? And the amount that are actually, when I ask them, what are you thinking or what are you doing with AI, there's quite limited elements from where I see the potential for this to go. Yes. Some of it is limiting. So if I think about it, if I look at it from the documentation point of view, I think the documentation, if you think about it, AI is good when you give it a formula,
yep.
right? So if you put the NCCs in and then you have an ability to put some standard ways of construction knowledge in, and this is where Revit, if you're using Revit or ArchiCAD, that's probably the biggest limiting factor. My question is what that's going to look like, because most people are using it for front-end designs and being able to provide multiple reiterations, but it's not necessarily, obviously the documentation in the back end is the biggest parts and the biggest man hours that's actually required. And that's where I'm interested, what your thoughts are and where you see it continuing to develop.
No, I agree, because I think there's, as I said earlier, rendering, like making 3D images, that's getting so fast, and it doesn't have to be perfect for a lot of clients. Because what you don't want is your client going, I did this in 2 minutes. I go, yeah, that sucks, but I understand your point. Like it takes someone 8 weeks to do something cool and you did it in 2 minutes, and it looks like a crap version of what we do, but I do understand.
Well, but at the end of the day, a render is only to give a client a visualization, or you're making it look pretty for marketing. Like, you know,
So it's a notional view of what you're trying to do. Mm. And so what I think people underestimate is their thing, architectural thing about how do I make my designs look cooler? Whereas reality is it should be how do I make my business run quicker and run smoother? So reporting, all the processes in the platforms in place, that you can do something quicker. So like, I've got an agent who's working out all the reporting for me, so that it says it in my voice. Like most architects, great at sitting in front of someone doing the report in the background, hate it.
Yeah.
Manual, hate it. That's where you can streamline your business and say, because what you've got to think about is what is the best use of talking to a senior architect? It's not because they can write a great report. It's because they have ideas I haven't thought of. Now, if you take 30% of their time away where they're having to do that stuff, it means they're spending less time on thinking up cool stuff for you. So if you can let them do what they're good at for longer, you're going to get so much higher value. And therefore, if you've got a company that's full of all these critical, amazing, creative thinkers and you're bogging them down with stuff that can be done or can be automated, that's where you're going to improve your business massively, because there's still everyone still needs them. So I think that's a really cool opportunity.
You still need people. You still need to be taking part and doing those things. So, look, I think there is absolutely enormous amounts of opportunity. What are some of the other things that you're sort of seeing as well across the industry outside of AI?
What I'm seeing is that everyone's really investing more in wellness and personal health more than they ever have. And I think trying to balance that with work is tricky. And I think what I'm trying to push, and what I've also learned, is you can't do it on your own. Like you can't run a business on your own. It's too hard. So you need other people around who are kind of removed from the company a little bit, and you get a different voice on it. So you go and someone go, you've talked about all this, but you're not, how are you managing this? You look like you're fired from day one. I've had people say I look different than when I worked. Way better, way clearer. My eyes are wider, all this stuff. And I didn't know. And so I can see that there's a real process of how people are running business that is very different than it was before. Like even gyms have changed. Like you're not trying to get jacked. You're actually trying to get longevity.
Absolutely. And I think that, and that is it. Like at the end of the day, do you, and this is the biggest difference from being in Melbourne versus in Queensland. I know we always sort of struggled with it, but when you come up here, you're kind of like, they work to live, not live to work. And I find that, you know, some cities it's more you work to live. It sort of has that. We all live an amazing life in Australia, by the way, an absolutely incredible life. But it is about the efficiency of if you actually do look after yourself, and it's about a longevity of a career and all of those. So whether it's the skills that you're looking to build, you know, having that philosophy, keeping that constant open mind, looking after your body, looking after your health, but also you're looking after your brain, whether it is that you've, you know, got an injury or health, but if it's just complete burnout, which I think majority of people have suffered from.
Yeah.
You kind of have to keep, because the stress is not necessarily going away. It's more how we manage the stress. And I mean, these days, the biggest problem is actually everybody looking at their phones all the time and creating digital fatigue and burning out the prefrontal cortex, you know, having dopamine cause, like everything is just stimulating us to the nth degree. And now we're going through massive change. And so there is going to be, through that, there's always winners and losers, and there's always lots of things that are going on with it too. So excellent. Now we'll need to close up there, Toby. We could probably keep talking all day. Now we always like to sort of say to people, is there a book, a podcast, or anything like that that you would recommend or think people should check out?
Yeah, that's a good question. Someone asked me the other day, who is the person you idolized to start advisory? Why did you do that? I said, well, funnily enough, we had really good senior advisors who helped us and kicked our ass into doing stuff that we didn't know. And so some of the stuff that I wouldn't recommend necessarily a book off the top of my head, but what I would make people do is make sure you look at stuff that is not work-related but is health-related in a business sense so that you understand how to put it together. Because if someone asked me, why do you do it? I said, I just want to leave my interaction with that person that they were better off knowing me than not knowing me. So if I've made their business better, that's where I wanted to do it. And so my advice, rather than for one single source, would be look outside the box of what you're doing and make sure you're looking after yourself, because if you're not looking after yourself, how can you project that to anyone else? So
well, and that's it. If you're not looking after yourself, how do you look after anybody else?
Exactly.
And particularly as the business owner, you know, you do have the stress of other people's mortgages and supporting people's families and all of that, that you have to be at your peak performance to sustainably be able to do that or be at your best on a long term. You're going to have ups and downs, but burning yourself out, nearly killing yourself is actually not going to help you or anybody else.
No, it's the number one thing for me is that I learned that I was heading in the wrong direction, and unfortunately it takes something bad to happen for us to change that. It shouldn't be that. And a lot of people are learning that along the way, but normally they are waiting for something to happen. And so I'm just saying, don't wait. You're ahead of it. You're in control of it. Just let other sources advise you along the way that this is how you do it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. And look, I 100% agree. It's like having a coach. You can run so far or so fast, or you can have somebody who's sort of been there and can observe it as an outsider. We have the same thing as well, that outside perspective gives a lot more insights than when you're in the thick of it and you're, you know, the one on the ground. It's a different part, and you can save a lot of time and a lot of money by just having a different viewpoint as well, and somebody who's been there and done that. So Toby, how do people get in touch with you if they're interested in the advisory that you're doing as well?
So I've got the website up there. It's just a sort of standing page one of youatadvisory.com.au, but I've also got LinkedIn. I don't use the Instagram as up. The LinkedIn's a good process, but otherwise it has my contact details on there. But I guess the main thing I like doing is that critical thinking and helping people just understand there's more to it than just work. And so you're setting up something to show your family how you should think about it. So I'd love to help. If I had money, I would do it for nothing. I love it.
And so, awesome. And that means you go to work and you love what you do. And I must say, I love that element too. So, look, thank you so much. I will include all of those things in the show notes. Excellent.
Thank you very much, Sydney. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.